first Star Wars movie opened 38 years ago, but its influence on pop culture and filmmaking still loom large. From action figures to video games, the franchise is said to be worth $40 billion. There have been 6 episodes, with a 7th, the start of another trilogy, due out later this year. Chris Taylor, deputy editor of the news website Mashable, joins us to explain how Star Wars conquered the entertainment universe, how George Lucas went from film student to blockbuster director. Star Wars, the past, present, and future of a multi-billion dollar franchise, after the news. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Our second hour. Thanks again for joining us. It's hard to believe that the first movie of the Star Wars franchise came out nearly 40 years ago. Since then, there have been 2 trilogies, several smaller films and animated television series, books and all types of merchandise from lightsabers to action figures. And yet, Star Wars was almost never made. Both United Artists and Universal passed on George Lucas's idea for an epic space adventure, and 20th Century Fox almost ended up selling the movie rights to a West German company. The Star Wars trilogies have raked in nearly $4.5 billion in worldwide ticket sales, making it the 5th highest-grossing film series of all time. Whether you're a fan of the classics who refuses to see the prequels, or if you were one of those people who waited in line for hours, maybe even days, to see every single episode, we think you'll find this hour of Midday of great interest. Our guest is Chris Taylor, deputy editor of the news website Mashable. He's out with a book about Star Wars, a pretty comprehensive one, I would say, on the history of this franchise, how Star Wars conquered the universe, the past, present, and future of a multi-billion dollar franchise, the publisher is Basic Books. Chris Taylor, I want to welcome you to the Midday Show on WYPR.
Thanks, Dan. It's great to be here.
Yes. What made you decide? Well, you've written about business and pop culture quite a bit in your career as a journalist, but, I mean, why this particular project?
Well, Star Wars has always been fascinating. I mean, I am not one who saw the original movie in 1977. I was just a little bit too young for that, and also the town that I grew up in, England, didn't even have a movie theater at the time. So I actually discovered Star Wars on the back of a cereal box in 1978. And then I went on to collect the figures, and I read the comic books, and I read the novelization. And I didn't even see the movie itself till 1982. So I'd already sort of experienced the way that this franchise isn't just about the movies. You know, you mentioned that it has made about $4.5 billion in ticket sales over the years. That is absolutely nothing compared to the merchandise that it's made. The $30 billion or so in licensed goods sold, connected with the franchise. Of course, Lucasfilm just gets a small portion of that. So it's really this fascinating topic because it's about so much more than the movies. It's about how this thing seeped into our popular culture. And round about the time that Lucasfilm was sold to Disney for $4 billion in October 2012 was when I noticed that there really hadn't been a comprehensive book written about the whole enchilada when it comes to Star Wars, the fans, the first trilogy, the second trilogy, the controversy of it. It was a really wonderful, meaty topic. And, of course, I've been fascinated with Star Wars ever since I saw that cereal box. So it was of great personal interest as well.
Well, Chris, I'm interested in this story about how the whole thing got started, of course, and how it almost didn't get started. I was curious about what was going on in movies in Hollywood in 1977. So I went to the Academy Awards listings for the Academy Awards, the Oscars of 1977, based on the ceremony of 1978. And I see Best Picture, Annie Hall. I see Star Wars did get nominated, but it's in there with The Goodbye Girl, Julia, and The Turning Point. Best Director, George Lucas got a nomination. So did Spielberg for Close Encounters of the Third Kind. But Woody Allen won for Annie Hall. It was the Annie Hall year, pretty much. And best original screenplay, also Annie Hall and not George Lucas. So I was wondering, you know, what was the resistance to this idea of a science fiction epic in 1970, whenever he made it, 74, 75, 76?
Yeah, yeah. He started writing in 73 and filmed it in 76. So it was about a three-year process there. Well, I mean, you know, we all sort of have in our heads the shorthand for what movies of the 70s were like. You know, they were dark. They were gritty. You know, The Godfather parts 1 and 2 dominated the decade. You had Scorsese coming out with Taxi Driver, which really changed a lot. And that was the thinking of what movies were in those days. You know, Woody Allen, I think part of the reason he won with Annie Hall is because it was one of the only pieces of sort of lighter fare that still tackled these very adult themes. You know, cinema was very adult in the 70s, and it's hard to remember that. You know, we're sitting here in a world where, you know, you've got the Hobbit, you've got the Lord of the Rings, you've got Pirates of the Caribbean. It's sort of taken as a given now that superheroes and science fiction and fantasy are what's hot at the box office. That was not the case in the 70s, and it's not what people thought. Science fiction was kids' stuff. There hadn't really been a big-budget science fiction movie or space fantasy movie, as George Lucas called Star Wars, pretty much at all. I mean, you had to go back to Forbidden Planet in 1955, which did not make a whole lot of money. 2001, you know, had barely made its money back by the time that Star Wars came out. You know, it just didn't seem to be a big bet. The things that studios were looking at were, you know, Dr. Zhivago, you know, was really popular in the 60s. The Sound of Music came out and everyone wanted to do a musical. You know, Laddie is the guy at 20th Century Fox who greenlighted Star Wars, said, you know, Hollywood is just full of lemmings. And there was nothing to follow in the science fiction realm, even though every director wanted to do something like this. You know, it wasn't just Lucas, it wasn't just Spielberg. You know, Scorsese was sniffing around science fiction. Brian De Palma, you know, would have loved to get into this area. But, you know, you had to do your dark, serious, gritty film. That's what directors were told in the 70s.
My reaction to Star Wars was that this was sort of a throwback. This was retro. Mm. I went with an older brother, much older than me. I have a brother who's some 16 years older than I am. And he said, this is Flash Gordon. This is the stuff we saw in the movie theater when I was a kid and that I saw probably on television in black and white, you know, in the 60s. Yes, Flash Gordon and others like that. So I thought it was kind of retro, you know.
That's exactly what it was based on. Your brother was precisely right. That was what Lucas was paying homage to. He was obsessed with the Flash Gordon serial. He only ever saw them on TV. He wasn't old enough to have seen them in the theater, but that was absolutely what he was going for, and that's why he started the saga, you know, right there in the middle. He really wanted to put, you know, episode 4 up on the screen, or episode 3, or, you know, to give you the sense that you were catching this in the middle of a Saturday morning serial, just made with a big budget. So yeah, Flash Gordon. You know, you can overwork that metaphor, but that's exactly what Lucas was paying homage to. That's definitely where it started out.
And Chris, where was George Lucas in life at that point? What had he been doing, and what else was he working on when the Star Wars idea, when he scribbled this down on a piece of paper?
Well, we often forget that Lucas was already a millionaire by the time that he came to write Star Wars at any serious level. He'd already done the treatment, but American Graffiti had come out in the summer of 73, and it was giant. I mean, you know, we don't really have any analogy today, but, you know, imagine a really successful, popular, independent movie that's made for almost nothing. I mean, I suppose the Blair Witch Project is sort of the most recent example of that, but that's what American Graffiti was, and it's a stunning film. You know, very much a nostalgic throwback to the early 60s. You know, where were you in 62 was the tagline. And it was very much, you know, Lucas was thinking about Vietnam the whole time. He was thinking about Flash Gordon, but he was also thinking about Vietnam when he wrote Star Wars. And, you know, Star Wars was going to be this sort of futuristic analogy of a Vietnam-like conflict. But American Graffiti was the nostalgia for a time before Vietnam tore America apart, and it really resonated. So that was a huge hit. His first movie THX-1138, which some of you may have seen, is very difficult to watch, and it's much more of a student film-like sort of dystopian kind of classic science fiction piece of work that really, you know, informed Star Wars in a lot of ways, not least of which the fact that Lucas realized, you know, you don't want to make really depressing science fiction because people won't go and see it.
Chris, so what was the biggest task that Lucas faced in convincing his studio to back him? This was going to cost some money, right?
It was, and nobody knew what the budget was going to be, and that was part of the biggest task, was trying to figure out how much money a studio would have to spend on this. I mean, Gary Kurtz, the producer of the original Star Wars, told me, you know, this was a real finger-in-the-wind time. You know, he came up with one budget that said $4 million. He came up with another budget that said $7 million. They eventually spent $11 million. Lucas often said that it was really a $20 million movie, but he just made it on a very, very tight budget. nobody knew how much this sort of thing was supposed to cost. The idea with science fiction at the time, as I say, was you were supposed to make it cheaply, and then you could just about make a return on your money. So that was a huge problem. The other thing is that Lucas just had a very hard time communicating what exactly this movie was about and what it would look like. And if you read those early scripts, you know, the first draft and the second draft, very, very different from how Star Wars turned out. You know, you see little sort of green buds of the Star Wars that we know and love, but really it's sort of this impenetrable Flash Gordon fan fiction is what I like to call it. It's really just very hard to get through, and you don't know who the hero is, and, you know, the droids are sort of unfamiliar and unrecognizable to us. So, you know, trying to explain a Wookiee to a studio executive in the early 1970s.
Thank you, Chris. Yeah, thank you. That says it all right there.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, by the way, casting of the original Star Wars is interesting. Is it true that Christopher Walken, that George Lucas thought of Christopher Walken as Han Solo?
Yes, I believe there were two slates for the main three actors, and the only reason that that Harrison Ford and company, you know, and Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill were chosen was that they were all available at the right time. They were all willing to work for, I think it was $1,000 a week was their standard wage. So it was really just about timing. But Walken was a possibility. Jodie Foster was a possibility. You know, a whole lot of actors were interviewed for this. But, you know, and of course, the famous story is that Harrison Ford was not allowed to participate because he'd been in American Graffiti, and Lucas didn't want anyone from that movie in this new movie. And the story goes that he was thrown in Lucas's path by Fred Roos, who's famously the producer on Godfather, Godfather Part Two, because Harrison Ford was a carpenter, you know, spent a lot of time as a carpenter in between acting gigs, and was doing a door for Fred Roos, and you know, Lucas just happened to be there in the studio at the time, and
wow,
was sort of this happy accident.
We're going to listen to a clip before we take our first break in this conversation with Chris Taylor. Mark Hamill is in this one. Actually, the voice of Yoda is Frank Oz, right?
Mm.
Yeah. So here's a clip from the original. Actually, this is from The Empire Strikes Back.
Always with you, what cannot be done. Hear you nothing that I say? You must unlearn what you have learned.
All right, I'll give it a try.
No, try not. Do or do not. There is no try.
Do or do not. I'm sorry, Chris. How many times are repeated lines from this movie? Including that one. This was so original and different, though, than anything we'd seen, I think.
Except
for maybe the Munchkins and the Wizard of Oz.
Well, it was, you know, the Muppet Show was very popular at the time and happened to be filming across the street from the original Star Wars.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, so it was very much on Lucas's mind.
Hey, Chris, we're going to talk some more. A lot to talk about with Chris Taylor. His book is How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, the Past, Present, and Future of a Multi-Billion-Dollar Franchise. If you'd like to join us for this conversation, please give us a ring, 410-662-8780. That's the number for the Midday Show at WYPR. Our toll-free long-distance number, If you're calling from a planet far, far away, 866-661-9309. And send us a question or comment by email, midday@wypr.org. Music from Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, Battle of the Heroes. Dan Roderick's here on Midday, spending this time with Chris Taylor to talk about his book on the Star Wars franchise, How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, the Past, Present, and Future of a Multi-Billion Dollar Franchise. We'll get to the future a bit later on as the Star Wars, another trilogy, starts at the end of this year, in December 2015. With the seventh film. So big question for you then, Chris. Why so popular? Why did people become so enamored with this series? And how has it been able to maintain its position as this really, truly a cultural phenomenon?
Well, I think the essential thing to remember about Star Wars is it's not really science fiction, right? You know, the very first thing we're told about it is it's set in the past, in the distant past, in a galaxy far, far away. And that makes it much more of a fairy tale, which is exactly what Lucas was going for. It got a little lost in the translation. You know, we saw this big budget epic, and we didn't really think fairy tale. But that's exactly what he was going for the whole way. You know, a lot of influences thrown into this. We talked about Flash Gordon. We talked about Vietnam. But he was very much looking for the, you know, the basis of all myths and all fairy stories, did a lot of reading of the Brothers Grimm before he wrote this. And we love that. You know, we're all, I think, looking for a certain amount of escapism in our lives. And it isn't just science fiction fans. It isn't just fantasy fans. You know, it's all of us. We all like a good adventure somewhere, you know, that doesn't relate to us in our everyday life. And Star Wars gave us permission to do that. You know, it was funny, it was accessible, it had very sexy lead actors, and, you know, everyone could get into it. And, of course, you know, within a couple of weeks, it was one of those bona fide, you know, cultural phenomenons, famous for being famous. So, you know, it was very much okay to go see it. And you had a brief period kind of between the trilogies where it wasn't cool, but It really didn't take a lot, you know, when we got the special editions in 1997, for Star Wars to become very, very cool again.
410-662-8780 is our phone number here. Midday Show. We have open phone lines if you'd like to compare notes or ask a question of Chris Taylor about the Star Wars franchise. I'm going to listen to another clip here, and before we go on, this is one that's a famous misquote, I think, but we ought to listen to it. It's the confrontation between Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker in The Empire Strikes Back.
Luke, you do not yet realize your importance. You have only begun to discover your power. Join me, and I will complete your training. With our combined strength, we can end this destructive conflict and bring order to the galaxy.
I'll never join you!
If you only knew the power of the dark side, Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father.
He told me enough! He told me you killed him.
No. I am your father.
So it's not, Luke, I am your father. It's, no, I am your father.
Yes.
What can you tell us about that twist, Chris? It's pretty interesting. This occurs at the end of The Empire Strikes Back, the second, but it's actually, you have to forgive me, I forget the order of things here, right? Because we're heading up toward prequels in the end of this year, right?
Yeah.
So,
we're heading towards sequels.
Sequels, because we already had
Empire
prequels.
Yes.
Sorry.
Empire Strikes Back is episode 5, you know, which really confused people at the time because they hadn't originally had episode 4 at the start of Star Wars, so it got really confusing for a while. So that's the famous twist that changed everything in the Star Wars universe, and the official story is that nobody saw that coming. But what I discovered for this book is that the actor inside the David, the Darth Vader suit, Dave Prowse, was telling people as early as 1977 that Darth Vader is Luke's father. So, you know, 3 years before the reveal comes out. And, you know, I mean, Lucas went so far as to have his Prowse's dialogue changed so that he wouldn't know that this twist was coming. But apparently he already knew it was coming. And, you know, I spent a long time investigating this for the book. And what I ended up with was just the fact that, you know, he guessed it. And it was not actually as surprising a twist as everyone has since suggested.
Star Wars, the original, was Episode 4.
Correct.
Actually called A New Hope. That was 1977. I'll just go through this quickly. Then The Empire Strikes Back was, as Chris says, Episode 5. And then 6 was Return of the Jedi. And then came... These were prequels. This is where I got a little confused. I had to go back and check all this. The Star Wars Episode 1 was The Phantom Menace, Episode 2, Attack of the Clones, and then Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith. And what's promised this year, Chris? This will be...
We have Episode 7, The Force Awakens.
Right, right. Now, this is a little different here in terms of the production of this. What exactly did Lucasfilms do? They made a deal with Disney, right?
Yes. So Lucas sold his company to Disney for about $4 billion in October 2012. And as part of that deal, he had got underway this new trilogy of movies. They're already committed to making episodes 7, 8, and 9, plus at least 2 spin-off films. The cast of writers for which keeps changing. We actually just had another... writer change on one of those spin-off films yesterday. So this is all eagerly watched by Star Wars fans, of course. But yes, we are heading into the sequel trilogy, which Lucas swore for years that he had never even written a single note on what these movies were going to be about, despite rumors floating around that he had several binders, black binders full of information. On episode 7, 8, and 9, he really didn't, and kept telling us that in interviews until the time came to sell the studio and go into retirement. And then all of a sudden, you know, treatments for these new movies popped up as part of that deal. So that's how it's being made. Lucasfilm is still an independent entity, much like Pixar and Marvel, both of which also owned by Disney, and very much in that vein that, you know, Lucasfilm is in charge of it. The only place where they're getting pushback from Disney is really on the release date. Lucasfilm was really hopeful that they could wait until 2016 to get this thing out, but director J.J. Abrams was on that train as well. You know, he's coming from the Star Trek franchise and hasn't had a whole lot of time to work on this and had to rewrite the script and. You know, a whole lot of drama has been going on behind the scenes, and we only just barely see what's going on. But yeah, Disney has pushed for this to be released in 2015, and so we will see it this December.
A question about George Lucas and all of this. What would you say about his attitude toward his own creation during all this time? Of course, it's made him immensely wealthy, and he's been able to do more movies as a result of the wealth from the original series. But, you know, this has consumed his life. This is what he's identified with forever and ever.
Said he knows that it's going to be the first line of his obituary.
Yeah, sure. How does he, as an artist, feel about that? Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, I mean, he's extremely ambivalent about it. It took him a long time to come to terms with it. You know, he was a student filmmaker at USC, and he was one of the leading lights of the independent filmmakers of the 70s and then became the sort of corporate studio boss that he himself had hated earlier on. And he's, you know, he's been quite open about this and lamented it on several occasions. He kept trying to ditch the Star Wars franchise. He tried to wrap everything up with Return of the Jedi and, it tied up all the loose ends, perhaps a little too quickly. And then, fans kept saying, you know, where are the other movies? You started with Episode 4. Where's 1, 2, and 3? And finally, after just about every other project he was in, except for Indiana Jones, became something of a flop. Lucas finally decided to return to episodes 1, 2, and 3, once the CGI had got to a level where he could use that in the production. He hated using puppets. He was always much more of an animation kind of guy. So he made those, and then again in 2005, he tried to say, that's it, it's over, no more movies, forget about it, get on with your lives. And, but then again, it came back to haunt him. And, he's described it as something that threw him up against a wall and beat him up, and just, it took him a long time to come to terms with that. But he's pretty sanguine about it. He also knows that Disney has thrown out his treatment for episodes 7, 8, and 9, and gone with something a little different. So
that's intriguing.
And he's sanguine about that. I mean, he's the one thing that he said throughout is he's the only geek in America who never really got to see a Star Wars film. He never got to wait in line and see it fresh.
Hey, yeah,
he's going to get to do that this time.
That's very interesting, because Bob is calling from Baltimore, Chris, with a story about standing in line. So, Bob, go right ahead. You're on with Chris Taylor, our guest on Midday. Hi.
Well, thank you. I'd just like to share a memory and ask one question. I was a graduate student at University of Arizona back in 1974, and they had a filmmakers convention there. And totally by chance, I was standing in line at the cafeteria, all of us with our trays, right behind Gene Roddenberry, who was the guest of honor, and George Lucas. They were ahead of me. And George Lucas was telling Gene about a film project he had in mind. And I had, I had no interaction with him, but I was overhearing the whole thing. And it wasn't until years later I realized I was listening to him talk about Star Wars before he even made it.
I would say in 1974, he was talking to the creator of Star Trek, right?
Yes, he was the guest of honor at the convention.
That's pretty good.
That's my single claim to fame in an otherwise unremarkable life.
Okay,
but my question was about Kurosawa's film, The Hidden Fortress, the Japanese film. Can you shed any light on the connection between that and Star Wars? Because the two are almost carbon copies of each other.
Sure. There is a connection between The Hidden Fortress and the very original treatment of Star Wars. And, there was actually famously a paragraph that was cribbed out of a book on Hidden Fortress that was basically just, science fictioned up and inserted into this treatment, almost word for word. But the more time went on, the more the script really got away from what Hidden Fortress was. And it was very much a starting point. It probably influenced the existence of a princess being held captive by an evil empire, but it's so many of these other elements were influenced by other things: the empire itself by Vietnam, the emperor by Richard Nixon, the whole look and feel of the thing by Flash Gordon. So Hidden Fortress is definitely in there. I watched the Kurosawa movies as part of this book, and I saw the DVD in which Lucas talks about Hidden Fortress and gives it this wonderful faint praise that it's his fourth favorite Kurosawa movie. But it's become very much associated with Star Wars. I think perhaps a little bit too much. I'm not sure I would agree that the plot is a carbon copy. I think it started there, but it moved away very, very quickly.
Chris Taylor's book is How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. Basic Books is the publisher. Chris, our guest in this hour of Midday, is deputy editor at Mashable. Here's another call for us. This is Will in Carroll County giving us a ring on Midday. Hi.
Hi. Question. What's your thought about Disney wiping out the expanded universe?
Yes.
What is that? Disney's wiping out the expanded universe. What does that
so,
mean?
So I should explain. The Expanded Universe is the name given to all of the novels and the comic books and the video games and everything that was sort of Lucas wasn't involved directly. And he's often claimed that he never actually read these novels. But, it's sort of they were overseen by Lucasfilm. And there were hundreds of them. And they told this story that, most of it went on after Return of the Jedi, and Luke Skywalker got married and had a kid, and Han and Leia had kids, and I won't spoil much more of it than that. But, you know, the kids go on to have these conflicts. Anyway, they announced last year that none of that actually happened within the Star Wars universe. They basically moved the expanded universe and novels and so forth to the universe next door and said, well, you know, we may mine it for parts. we may take some spare parts out of that, but basically it's not going to have any influence on Episode 7. This didn't happen in between. You know, so we know that Episode 7 is set 30 years later after Return of the Jedi, but we also don't know what's happened in between. And I think that was sort of, you know, a lot of fans are very angry. They've spent a lot of money on these books. But I also think, I have to say, it was a necessary move because otherwise that would really lock J.J. Abrams and Lawrence Kasdan, his co-writer, also co-writer on Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. It would really lock them into a set frame of a plot, mm-hmm. you know, based on these novels. And I really don't think that would be useful. It'd be very hard to bring the more casual audience, the general audience, on board. And also, you know, these books were of a very uneven quality. I mean, we could talk for hours about books like the Courtship of Princess Leia, for example, in which Han Solo basically kidnaps Princess Leia and with something called the Gun of Command. I mean, there were some very, very silly notions in some of these books. The quality was uneven. They are starting afresh with something called a story group, the Lucasfilm story group, that is coordinating everything going forward, all of the new novels, all of the new comic books, the new games, so that it all deliberately fits into a larger story. So I think that's a very bold move. It's not, you know, a reset or a retcon, which is something you often get with things like the Marvel Universe. They had to do that. It's more of a very, very drastic amputation. So I think it was necessary.
A question about the Disney's involvement is on the mind of Jean in Annapolis, who wrote to us to say that she's heard that George Lucas has allowed and even encouraged Star Wars fans to create art based on the series. We know that to be true, but will this continue now that Disney has bought the rights?
Yeah. I mean, there's still a very thriving fan community out there. You see an awful lot of fan-written Star Wars stories online, and Disney has not clamped down on that. I think they're very well aware of the need to let the fandom do what it does, and that the fans are a huge part of this. I mean, for big example of that, which I wrote about in the book, is the fans who make their own R2-D2s, right? They sit in their garages for 10 years sometimes, making this screen-accurate R2-D2. And Lucasfilm, for a long time, was very wary about giving those fans any sort of specific measurements to make this what it was essentially a licensed product. But they came to embrace it. And what Kathleen Kennedy, who is now the president of Lucasfilm, the successor to George Lucas, and you know, she's right there in the Disney hierarchy. She actually chose some of the best R2-D2 builders to make the R2-D2 for Episode 7. So, you know, that was an incredible signal to the fans saying, hey, you know, we hear you, we like what you're doing. Sometimes you actually do it better than we can. Because these fan-made droids, they were a lot cheaper and ran a lot better than Lucasfilm could ever do themselves.
Chris Taylor, we'll take another break here. As we do, it's a little more nostalgia, another clip from The Empire Strikes Back as we go into our break here. Han Solo trying to shake off those Imperial ships by flying that Falcon through an asteroid field. Remember, that was very daring.
That wasn't a laser blast. Something hit us.
Han, get up here.
Come on, Chewie.
Asteroids.
Chewie, set 271.
What are you doing? You're not actually going into an asteroid field.
They'd be crazy to follow us, wouldn't they?
You don't have to do this to impress me.
Sir, the possibility of successfully navigating an asteroid field is approximately 3,720 to 1.
Never tell me the odds.
Welcome back to Midday, spending this hour with Chris Taylor, who's deputy editor of Mashable, that has written a book about the Star Wars franchise, How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, it's called. And Chris, I get the sense you find all of this a bit strange, that this became so popular. I mean, you're fascinated with it. You don't sound like you were exactly a Star Wars nerd before the project. Maybe you became one. I don't know.
I was one of those original trilogy fans who was personally felt rather let down by the prequels, I have to say.
Okay, we have some affinity there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and it's interesting. This part of this project has helped me come to terms with that and make my peace with the prequels and understand really what Lucas was going for. That he, you know, was much more in the vein of Flash Gordon, I think, for these movies. They have the feel of a Saturday morning serial. I don't think they're as edited as well as they could be, but you know, I think people took them a little too seriously, and it was very interesting to step back from that and take a look at all of that passion and that hatred that seems to exist almost in equal measure with the love that exists in the Star Wars fandom. And sort of see it from above and see what is all this about? Why is this happening? And really come up with this notion that there were two ideas of what Star Wars was from the beginning, George Lucas's and everyone else's. you know, we really got an object lesson in the prequels with what George Lucas was going for in the first place. You know, something much more cartoonish, something much more goofy.
Is it too late to become a new fan of the original trilogy at this point? Say you somehow missed this. I don't know how that's possible, but it is. It is possible. This film came out 38 years ago, the original.
Yes.
But I wonder.
38 years ago.
Yeah. In the experience of writing this book and doing the research, looking at the movies again, watching the movies again, is it too late to become a fan of the original? And do they hold up pretty well?
I think they do, and I think new fans are minted every day because you have a generation of parents now who are, you know, rather surprised to become the Darth Vader in their household, who are, you know, very, very determined that their kids are going to watch the original trilogy first. You know, they're not going to watch it in numerical order. One of my favorite T-shirts reads, Episode 4 comes first, it's just good parenting. And you know, there are all sorts of debates about which order you should watch them in. And, you know, there's something called machete order, which is you watch Episode 4, so the original Star Wars, Episode 5, Empire Strikes Back. Then you go back to 2 and 3 before ending with 6, Return of the Jedi. The reason being that, you know, A, you don't need Episode 1, Phantom Menace at all. Everyone important in that movie dies. And you know, if you go to 2 or 3, you just sort of see them together. What you're getting is an extended flashback after the "I am your father" revelation, kind of looking back at what Anakin Skywalker's life was like.
That's an interesting suggestion, Chris. Thank you. I may take another stab at that.
There's your weekend.
Yeah, let's listen to another clip. Now this one is from, let's see, this is the one you say we can forget, Episode 1, because it's just confusing.
Yeah, right? I mean, you know, watch it if you have time. But
okay, all right. So the Jedi Master, played by Liam Neeson, is explaining to Anakin's mother that the Force is strong with Anakin.
You should be very proud of your son. He gives without any thought of reward.
Well, he knows nothing of greed.
He has special powers.
Yes.
He can see things before they happen. That's why he appears to have such quick reflexes. It's a Jedi trait.
He deserves better than a slave's life.
The Force is unusually strong with him. That much is clear. Who was his father?
There was no father.
So confusing.
The mysterious virgin birth.
Yes.
Of Anakin Skywalker. Major controversy.
Chris, where did the idea for the Force come from? Do we know? Did Lucas ever talk about that?
Yeah, like a lot of things, it came from a lot of places. You know, a lot of religions talk about life force, or prana, or chi. you know, this stuff was talked about a lot in the 70s. And, you know, it was everywhere from comic books to the Carlos Castaneda books, if you remember those. The Yagi Way of Knowledge, you know, all of that stuff about the mystic Don Juan. Mm-hmm. So that was part of it. But really, one of Lucas's first encounters with the term goes back to an independent film in the 60s called 2187. Which is just a 10-minute film. You can look it up on YouTube, and it's fascinating because about halfway through it, there's this discussion. It's sort of just this, you know, bits of film tied together with a very, very loose theme, but there's a discussion about people feeling some sort of force or something, and they call it God. So basically, the force was the result of Lucas sort of trying to reconcile his own feelings about God for many years, and trying to figure out why there were so many religions but one God, and all of this stuff that a lot of us go through in our own philosophical processes. And this was how he resolved it. He basically created a quote-unquote religion that is equally acceptable to, you know, to atheists and Christians and Buddhists and Hindu and Muslim and Jewish people. You know, it really has a tremendous universal impact, and it's just sort of something that people are able to lay over their own religious belief.
And the film you referenced just then was 2187.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah.
I'm going to read an email that you'll probably identify with. Stephanie writing to say that the book was published a year before the movie came out when I was in eighth grade. Is that correct, by the way?
Yes. Okay. The book came out in, I believe, November, December 1976.
Oh, okay.
Which was around about the original release date of Star Wars, which got pushed forward to May because it basically just wasn't ready in time. But they kept the book and its release date. And that was a very, very smart move because it meant that, I mean, it was on the bestseller lists, and you had these hundreds and thousands of science fiction fans who already knew the story, and they were very, very eager to see it on the big screen. So very smart marketing move.
Stephanie says, I always took pride in the fact that that I read the book first. It made me feel like I had discovered something cool before the rest of the world knew what was coming. Oddly enough, I didn't actually see the movie until a few years later in high school. I think it was on television, even before cable. So it's similar to your own experience with this.
Yeah, yeah. People keep coming to it fresh. And, you know, just when you think that everyone in the universe must have seen this film. You know, my whole first chapter is about trying to find someone who's never actually seen it, and doesn't know anything about it. And I had to go to a screening of Star Wars in the Navajo Nation in Arizona to actually find that person. But yeah, fascinating hunt.
A question for you about the fans, the most obsessed fans or most extreme fans. I find this really interesting. Do we have time for the story of the 501st Legion?
I can tell that very quickly. It all started with one guy, an amputee in South Carolina, Albin Johnson, and he decided to get a stormtrooper suit one day. Well, actually, a friend of his persuaded him to do it because he was kind of depressed about having lost his leg. But inside a stormtrooper suit, nobody knows you're an amputee. And, you know, he and his friend dressed up as stormtroopers and started patrolling movie theaters, and they discovered that the more stormtroopers you have together, the more people are just a little bit afraid, but, you know, definitely excited. One stormtrooper alone, you think it's just a nerd in a costume. Two stormtroopers, a little bit scary. Three stormtroopers, very scary. And he thought, you know, I'm going to get 10 stormtroopers together in the same room, and it's going to be awesome. And now at last count, I think they have around 7,000 people around the world with these screen-accurate stormtrooper costumes.
Wow.
So the only way to get into the club is make your own costume and make it screen-accurate.
Did some of them get on the screen?
They have been mentioned in... They were used in Episode 3. It wasn't actually 501st members, but at the end of Episode 3, you have the newly minted Darth Vader going into the Jedi Temple to massacre a bunch of Jedi kids, including, oddly enough, George Lucas's own son, Jet. And in the script, it says that they are the 501st Legion. You know, these clone troopers that are marching in behind the new Darth Vader. And You know, that made things a little bit awkward when Jet Lucas asked to become a member of the 501st Legion. And Albin Johnson had to look at him and say, didn't we kill you in the Jedi Temple? But yeah, there was definitely an homage to that. You know, Lucas, well aware of them, loved what they did. And, you know, another great example of fandom coming around and getting involved in the Star Wars itself.
Chris, which character would you say is the most, I guess, beloved versus popular or just best known? Beloved, is there a way to measure that in terms of the Star Wars characters?
Well, they've done for a couple of years now a sort of March Madness style contest on StarWars.com called This Is Madness. And the first year's winner of that, you know, basically it's sort of these brackets where the characters face off against each other. First year winner, I believe, was Yoda. And I think the second year it went to Vader. I'm not 100% on that, but you know, it seems to be the masked creatures are much more beloved than the actors. Of course, you know, if you talk to a lot of people, it's Harrison Ford as Han Solo will never be beaten. But you know, there's a certain timelessness to the droids, to Darth Vader, to alien creatures like Yoda. You know, that really seems to appeal to people. But I have to say, probably the most loved character and the one you see people swarming to at every convention or every other appearance is R2-D2. And that was very much Luke's favorite character. And he's indeed said on many occasions that, you know, that this whole story of the Star Wars universe, all of these movies, is actually just being told in retrospect by R2-D2 many years later, which might explain the fact that he never seems to do anything wrong. It's about the only character that does it.
What I always liked about it was that if you felt like these folks had been in space on this planet or in these in the Falcon all along, you know, that Han Solo, he seemed so at home, like an old hand, like he'd been up there for years and we just happened to be stepping in to watch an episode in his life.
It has that great feeling to it.
It does.
It did just step into the middle of things. And that very much comes from Japanese films as well. Lucas was very influenced by Kurosawa, of course, but by other Japanese movies, where they don't take a lot of time to explain things to you.
Right,
and you really
exactly.
do get the feel that you're just...
Yeah,
you're just stepping in.
Yeah, no, he steps into the bar, and there's all these strange-looking characters there, and he's used to seeing them all. He knows some of them, right? I always thought that was a cool aspect of it. Anyway,
absolutely.
Chris, really enjoyed this. It's nice to get some time with you, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Yep. Chris Taylor, who is a deputy editor at Mashable, but his book out now is How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, the Past, Present, and future of a multi-billion-dollar franchise published by Basic Books. Well, thanks again, Chris.
Thank you, Dan.
Okay.
A lot of fun.
Yep, and thank you, everybody, for tuning in. The last note about that, December 2015, we'll see the seventh film and the beginning of the third trilogy, the sequels, coming up. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the program, everybody, and have a great afternoon. Dan Rodericks for our staff here at Midday. We'll see you again tomorrow.
Midday senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richmond, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Rodgick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.